You can't frack for natural gas in New York, but that ban doesn't apply to pipelines carrying Pennsylvania gas or the building of natural gas power plants that need fuel.
How did this happen? This was all wetlands, and all of a sudden a fracked gas plant is approved and pops up?
I'm Carol Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, activists are wrestling with the demand for cheap natural gas. Plus, scientists look at novel ways to stop an invasive pest from killing hemlock trees.
To come up with a simple response to a complex interaction like a tree and an insect is just fool's game. That being said, I'll admit to being a fool.
And many of us love glitter.
It adds a little sparkle to life.
But it's spreading more than holiday cheer in our waterways. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Hundreds of miles of new natural gas pipelines have run up against community opposition nationwide. Pennsylvania's Marcellus Shale gas is starting to pour over the border into New York, where new gas-fired power plants are planned. In a partnership with the Center for Public Integrity, State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports that although New York banned fracking, it seems willing to gobble up Pennsylvania's fracked gas.
On a rainy Saturday, about 100 people line a busy road in upstate New York. They've been meeting here every week for 3 years. They hold signs, they chant, they sing. They're protesting construction of a massive new natural gas power plant that will run on Pennsylvania's abundant Marcellus shale gas. CPV's Valley Energy Center in Wayweyanda, New York, is huge and gray, and includes towers reaching 275 feet high overlooking the countryside. Despite these weekly rallies, civil disobedience, and lawsuits, construction on the nearly $1 billion plant is almost complete.
But why now? Why in 2016, 2017 do we have a fracked gas plant, you know, sitting in the middle of Orange County?
Ken Pinkella grew up here in nearby Otisville on land that had been a dairy farm for 8 generations. Pinkella says in the age of climate change, solar and wind power should be developed, not new fossil fuel plants.
Someone thought this was a good idea. Can you imagine? You go by at night, you see the two blinking red eyes in the sky now.
The answer to his question lies in Pennsylvania's abundant and cheap supply of natural gas. For producers and power plant operators, it's a great idea. Natural gas prices are low, and Pennsylvania's producers need new customers. CPV executives, local officials, and labor leaders touted cheaper utility bills, cleaner burning fossil fuel, fewer carbon emissions, a state-of-the-art facility that would use 85% less water than current plants, hundreds of good-paying jobs, and enough electricity to power 600,000 New York homes. The tiny town of Wayweyanda, population 7,000, also stands to gain. In 2014, the company inked an $11 million deal with the town. New York State gave the plant all the necessary environmental permits, and by the time the larger surrounding community found out, many, like Pinkella, questioned the environmental reviews.
How did this happen? This was all wetlands, and all of a sudden a fracked gas plant is approved and pops up?
Nobody from Governor Andrew Cuomo's office, the CPV power plant company, or local Wayweyanda officials would talk to us about the project. And this shows just how politically toxic this gas plant and any new gas infrastructure projects have become, especially for a state like New York, which is committed to developing renewable energy. Tom Denny got involved protesting the plant after he started to get headaches, which he blames on new natural gas compressor stations.
I keep saying, oh, I should take a break. I don't think it's that effective. They've got the upper hand. They've got so much money.
Denny worries about new sources of air pollution from the gas plant. He also worries about what happens across the border in Pennsylvania.
One of the biggest concerns is every year they're going to have to do 150 wells to feed this monster. And that means 150 neighborhoods in Pennsylvania are going to deal with more contamination of their water.
Denny drives me through rural Orange County to the site of the proposed Valley Lateral Pipeline. This planned 7.8-mile-long pipeline would feed the CPV power plant. Without it, the nearly $1 billion natural gas plant in Wayweyanda is worthless.
And essentially coming right out here in front of my mailbox.
Melody Brunn owns 80 acres of open fields and forest, which is in the path of the pipeline. Brunn doesn't go to protests. Instead, she hired lawyers to fight the taking of her land. And what's even more vexing for Brunn is what she sees as the hypocrisy of the state's fracking ban.
They ban fracking, but yet you can transport frack gas. Does that even make sense? And you can have pipelines with frack gas? It's nonsense. It's absolutely
And yet, nonsense. In a twist that surprised all sides, New York's Department of Environmental Conservation rejected the water permits for the pipeline. Remember, without that pipeline, CPV's gas plant won't be able to operate over the long term. Michelle Hook is a spokesperson for Millennium, the line's builder and operator.
So we were really the only thing standing between that plant running and not running.
Hook says Millennium bent over backwards to comply with New York's environmental regulations. But the rejection actually had nothing to do with water. The New York Department of Environmental Conservation rejected those permits based on climate change concerns, stemming from the new natural gas plant. So, does the state regret approving the power plant? A spokesperson for the department wouldn't really answer that question, but said the decision was based on facts, science, and merit. Hook thinks the growing political pressure to reduce carbon emissions is playing a role.
There was quite a bit of opposition that didn't really mobilize itself and become organized until after the plant had been permitted. And by the time they got mobilized and made enough noise, we were the only ones that still needed permits.
Now, state and federal authorities are battling in court over who has authority of this short little pipeline. But in the meantime, the pipeline builders have begun construction, starting with tree clearing. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
When people oppose fracking activity, they often say it's over concerns about health. There's some news on that front. According to a new study, infants born to mothers who live very close to natural gas fracking sites have a higher risk for low birth rate. Researchers looked at data from more than 1 million births in all Pennsylvania counties over a period of 10 years and found that babies born to mothers who lived within about a half a mile of a well site were 25% more likely to have low birth weight. Beyond about 2 miles, they found no impacts. The study is the largest of its kind and builds on previous research showing a connection between fracking and infant health. Janet Curry is an economics professor at Princeton University and one of the researchers of the new study, published in Science Advances.
It is generating a lot of economic activity. It also has health effects. What we need to think about is how can we maintain the economic benefits while reducing the cost.
Curry says policy should use this growing body of information to balance the clear economic benefits of gas production with protecting residents living very close to fracking sites. Bernard Goldstein is a retired professor from the University of Pittsburgh's Graduate School of Public Health. He says it's a relatively small impact in terms of the individual mother and child, and cautions that not all low birth weight babies go on to suffer problems later in life.
The next thing we should be doing is focusing on getting a better idea of the exposures caused by the whole activity of shale gas.
The researchers speculate that the problems are caused by increased air pollution and suggest requiring low-cost air monitors at fracking sites. There's more at AlleghenyFront.org. Nothing says the holidays like time spent with family and hunting.
With the foil-covered license on my back, I went to my grandparents ready to meet the same rite of passage as many of my friends.
Later on the Allegheny Front, memories of snowy woodlands, family traditions, and perhaps most importantly, hot chocolate. That's coming up. Stay tuned. This time of year, glitter is everywhere. Holiday cards, decorations, and it turns out, in our waterways. First, to get to the bottom of our love for glitter, I visited Little House Big Art, a crafting studio in Pittsburgh's Spring Hill neighborhood. 8-year-old Imogen Nowak was there looking for just the right beads.
Do you want some more? You got enough?
Okay.
She's making a surprise Christmas gift for her mom. And while she's not using any glitter today, it's a favorite.
Which is why I add glitter to things that I'm making or things that I love. It adds a little sparkle to life.
Owner Elizabeth Basher says they go through a lot of it here.
About 100% of the people who come in find some way to use glitter.
So when Basher saw some recent headlines calling glitter an environmental hazard, well, it was hard.
We're kind of heartbroken.
In November, an article in the UK's Independent and then in other publications reported a big problem with glitter and calls from some scientists to ban it.
We've all had these experiences, right, of having a kid's birthday party or, you know, having a craft event with, you know, with your kids, and the glitter comes out and, you know, 3 years later, you're still finding it in and amongst your house.
Except it doesn't stay in your house. I talked with Sherry Mason, a chemist at the State University of New York at Fredonia, about this. She studies plastic pollution in the Great Lakes. And she says when you wash your hands or clothes to get rid of glitter, that's where it ends up, in lakes, rivers, and oceans.
The vast majority of plastics that we find in the environment are these small pieces of plastic that are considered microplastics. I mean, majority of glitter is just, it's a microplastic.
Microplastics are technically 5 millimeters in diameter or smaller. Mason says most are more like a millimeter. They can be manufactured that way, like most glitter on the market, or might start out as a macroplastic, a bottle of water that's been ground down by the elements. Researchers estimate 10,000 metric tons of plastic debris enter the Great Lakes every year. Until recently, there were microplastics called microbeads in facial scrubs and toothpaste. Mason's discovery of tiny plastics in Lake Erie helped lead to federal legislation, the Microbead Free Waters Act of 2015, banning their use in some consumer products. What impact do microplastics have once they're in the water?
Plastics, by their nature, are very good at absorbing pollutants from the external environment onto their surface. Things like, you know, polychlorinated biphenyls, polyaromatic hydrocarbons, things that are known to be carcinogens, mutagens, endocrine disruptors, and they stick to the surface, and then these microplastics act to move them from the external environment into the food chain.
Fish eat the tiny pieces of plastic, and chemicals can be passed through their flesh to us. The plastic itself might even break into smaller pieces that lodge into the meat we eat. And while facial washes are no longer made with microplastics in the U.S., glitter is still pretty common in makeup.
In response to some of the recent headlines and concern over glitter as an environmental issue, some others have said, you know, glitter really isn't the biggest piece of our problem with plastic. So, you know, let's not focus on a glitter ban. Let's focus on other parts of the equation. What would you say to that?
I can understand, you know, kind of both approaches. Glitter is not the biggest piece of the pie, but it's an easy piece, I think, as a society for us to get rid of. We have a society that is very much based on disposability and convenience, right? And it's hard for people to imagine a world without plastic bags. And so those are harder things in some ways, I think, to tackle, you know, the convenience of food to go and all of that. So I think any piece of the pie that we can easily deal with, we should. I don't know if we need to ban it, I think, you know, but we saw with the microbeads, it's a difficult thing. Like, you want people to just make the changes in their life when they know that that's an easy and the right change to make, except a lot of people don't pay attention to what's happening in environmental news. They're too busy, you know, trying to pay the bills and make it to the soccer game and work 3 jobs and take care of health insurance, you know, to worry about whether or not they use glitter in their holiday crafts. And so that's really where legislation can step in and make these things, you know, much more universal as a part of society. It's a way to change society for the better so that people don't have to be looking at their back of their face wash or the back of their eyeshadow to know if it has glitter in it.
If all of this bums you out, Mason suggests we could use less glitter or switch to a sustainable, biodegradable brand. Elizabeth Basher at Little House Big Art found one made in Denmark.
It's a much higher cost, but I think we'll probably go ahead and do that. And then it's compostable. So it'll be, we'll have glitter in our community garden.
Or you could use something other than glitter to make holiday crafts festive. At a Poidea Apiary's holiday open house, kids are learning to make seed bombs. This year, it's without glitter.
What do you think that bees need just like people need?
Honey?
They make honey, but what do they eat? What do they need?
Flowers.
They do. They need flowers and they eat pollen.
Roxanne Swan from the Audubon Society of Western Pennsylvania sprinkles native wildflower seeds into an aluminum pan filled with soil.
You just mix it up like this. And if we were just to leave it like this, we couldn't make a ball. It pretty much falls apart. So what we're going to do is just mix a tiny bit of water in.
She forms little balls from the pliable seed and soil mixture, then rolls them in another pan of perlite, white volcanic glass that's not sharp and can help with soil drainage. The perlite replaces decorative glitter.
What do you think? Does it look like a snowball or even like a candy?
Swan reminds David Moroz they're not for people to eat. He's rolling his own seed bombs.
Kind of muddy.
What are you going to do with them?
Throw them out so the bees can have them and they'll grow into giant flowers.
Swan says you can toss seed bombs onto the edge of a yard or hillside or even along the side of a road now to create habitat for bees and other pollinators later. Happy holidays, little guys. As always, there's a lot more at our website, AlleghenyFront.org, including a link to the recipe for making your own glitter-free seed bombs. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapel. So we just heard about making seed bombs with native wildflower seeds to create habitat and food for bees. Turns out, using native plants in your yard rather than non-native species is better for birds. Rebecca Williams has more.
A study on Carolina chickadees and the caterpillars they eat finds that native plants are better at providing food for birds. Desiree Narango is the lead author. She's a research fellow at the Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center in Washington, D.C.
From the chickadee's perspective, it's as if a non-native plant isn't even there at all because they almost never forage in them.
Narango studied the chickadees that look for food in people's backyards, in cities and suburbs. She found that native plants were better homes for the caterpillars that chickadees eat.
But most importantly, we found that the backyards that had more native plant species were much more likely to have breeding pairs of chickadees as well.
On top of that, she says other kinds of birds seem to benefit too.
When we followed our chickadees around, we also saw lots of other species like migratory warblers and orioles and tanagers and all these species that may not necessarily breed in these urban areas but are using them during migration. And so the chickadees are really kind of serving as an indicator for which trees are really important for insectivorous birds in general.
And she says certain kinds of native plants seem to be especially good.
We did find that some species, like oaks and cherries and elms, support many species of caterpillars, so they're also really great food hubs for birds.
She says hickories and maples are good, too. But Narango says oaks were the standouts. They found more than 530 different species of caterpillars on oak trees. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Rebecca Williams.
You can check out Narango's list of which native plants hosted the most caterpillars at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. The hemlock woolly adelgid is almost impossible to see with the naked eye, but the tiny insect causes a lot of damage to hemlock trees and their surroundings. That's likely to get even more serious as a warming climate allows it to move further north. WXXI's Caitlin White went to Ithaca, New York for Great Lakes Today to learn about plans to fight back against the pest.
On a rainy day, city forester Jean Grace takes me on a tour of the city cemetery, where tall evergreen trees hang over many of the graves, hemlock trees. The cemetery has the peace and quiet of any cemetery, but if you take a closer look at the hemlock branches, I mean real close, you'll spot the hemlock woolly adelgid.
So you kind of like, you need like a microscope or a hand lens to really see them. There's kind of one right there, that little bump. I think that's it. Yeah, I just squished it.
Oh my God.
They're really little.
I think it was on your fingertip.
Yeah, so it takes like millions of them.
This hemlock tree, like many in the Great Lakes region, is coated with this white, waxy, fluffy material right where the needles meet the branch. It looks like a light snow has fallen on the tree. Once the tiny bug makes its way to a hemlock tree, it sticks its mouth parts in the branch, hides in this coating, and essentially sucks the life out of the tree.
So when you have millions of these on a single tree, that's making millions of little wounds in the tree that the tree then tries to wall off, and then it just kind of plugs up the whole vascular system of the tree.
Think of it like little scabs, preventing nutrients from flowing through the tree. The hemlocks are easy to protect in a contained space like the cemetery. The city uses an insecticide. But it's harder in areas like gorges, where many hemlocks grow and are essential to the surrounding ecosystem. We take a walk down to a gorge near the cemetery.
The kind of geological situation we've got here is we have all this really loose shale that slowly erodes as the gorges get bigger and bigger. And what the trees do is the tree roots kind of create a network that holds all that soil together and kind of holds the gorge and prevents it from eroding as fast as it would without the trees there.
So lose the hemlocks and you eventually lose the gorge. But scientists are looking for a way to fight back. Mark Whitmore is an entomologist at Cornell University in Ithaca. He suspects that warmer winters are contributing to the insect spread, but it's complicated.
To come up with a simple response, especially to a complex interaction like a tree and an insect, is just fool's game. But that being said, I'll admit to being a fool.
He says hemlock woolly adelgids are sensitive to cold, but last winter, one of the warmest on record, populations went through the ceiling.
I was amazed that they could go through actually 3 years of very high mortality and still bounce back. And I expect them now, with the mild winter we had, and perhaps if with another mild winter, the populations to begin spreading much more rapidly.
Whitmore takes me to his new $1.2 million lab dedicated to protecting hemlocks. This is where the Laricobius nigrinus comes in. It's a beetle just slightly smaller than a sesame seed. In Japan, where the hemlock woolly adelgid originates, these beetles are a natural predator and keep the adelgids in check. Under a microscope in Whitmore's lab, a branch covered in hemlock woolly adelgid fuzz sits in a dish. The Laricobius nigrinus is tearing apart the adelgid fluff, like a kid unwrapping presents on Christmas morning. When it finds and eats the adelgid inside, it moves on to the next one. Whitmore collects these bugs himself.
I think I caught about 2,600 beetles, and I hope to multiply them by 10 times. Maybe that's a modest goal, but that would make 26,000. And that's a significant increase, and that's what we need to do for year in and year out.
Still, Whitmore says we will never get rid of the hemlock woolly adelgid. They travel by wind or perhaps on birds and deer, and they're asexual, so all it takes is one to start a new population. For Great Lakes Today, I'm Caitlin White.
Great Lakes Today is a collaboration led by WBFO Buffalo, IdeaStream Cleveland, and WXXI Rochester. For more stories, check out greatlakestoday.org. Deer hunting is a rite of passage for many Pennsylvanians. Writer Patrick Wagner remembers his first and only hunting trip. We've aired this story before, but I just wanted to hear it again.
I grew up in the middle of Pennsylvania, Montour County to be exact. Deer hunting was a tradition that came with the snow in this tiny spot in the north central part of the state. Some years would go by unscathed by winter storms, but more often than not, the blaze orange would be framed in white snow. My mom grew up in the middle of the woods a few counties over, in a house my grandparents built 60 years ago when they were young. That home, nestled between a hill and a creek, was the site of my first and only hunting trip, and the first trips of countless men and women in my family, dating at least back to the time when this area was the frontier. Through childhood, my grandparents' house was as close to a magical place as I knew. Countless forts had been built, bows and arrows fired, and ponds skated upon by the time I was 13. That's the age when it had become clear that I was the only one of the three grandchildren who took enough of an interest in hunting to go with my grandparents into the open space that was just out their back door. With the foil-covered license on my back, I went to my grandparents ready to meet the same rite of passage as many of my friends. While my grandmother Olive and I stood ready on the back porch, guns in hand, blaze orange vests and hats pulled down, my grandfather sorted through his various hunting supplies in the house, looking for a different orange hat than the one he had on. I don't think he ever found it, but we waited and waited, our breath ushering forth like two dragons. When he was done getting ready, Granddad's attire was more that of a gentleman with his broad-brimmed hat than a sniper in camouflage. While he searched, my grandma decided it would be a good idea to reinforce a few ideas about safety. We were talking casually about the safeties on my Winchester and her Remington when, with a quick flick of her finger, her gun went off, firing a bullet away from me and through the garage a few feet away. She was mortified, and so was my grandfather when he stuck his head out the door and yelled an extremely infrequent curse word. Though the incident was shrugged off as the accident it was, it remains a lesson in safety that my mom's family still remembers. The accident didn't deter us that day. We made our way to the tree stand in the middle of their woods. A short ladder led to the wooden platform, foliage only lightly hanging in the trees. We waited, and waited, and waited some more as my grandmother stood below and my grandfather stalked the woods like a spirit in the trees. Finally, we heard a shot. Perhaps another hunter, my grandmother thought, but it soon generated a few deer hurtling towards the stand from the west. I quickly aimed my gun, but the doe were too far away, covered in the dense foliage of a dry creek bed. My grandmother stayed her shot as well, and within a few minutes my grandfather appeared, claiming the gunshot as his own, though even he knew it hadn't hit its intended target. With that failed drive, we called it a day. After unloading our rifles and taking off our blaze orange, we went on to the most traditional of Tannersville post-hunting outings, the locally famous Snydersville Diner. Served by tenured waitresses wearing nurses' smocks and an old rail car, my grandparents both ordered a cup of coffee, while I asked for a hot chocolate with whipped cream on top. Even as I sipped the hot brew, I could see the old trees that shaded the parking lot and had to wonder if there was a deer watching me. I haven't been hunting since then. My grandparents were aging and I was busy with school, but it was a day in the grand cathedral of my ancestors that will always be dear to me. I'm Patrick Wagner.
Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, at Allegheny Front. And don't forget about our podcast, Trump on Earth. Listen on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, or at trumponearth.org. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.